Hi, this is Sarah. If you like this episode of Let's Talk About Sects, you can listen to my audiobook, Do As I Say, How Cults Control, Why We Join Them, and What They Teach Us About Bullying, Abuse and Coercion. The audiobook will be available on Audible, Apple Books, Google and Kobo from the 28th of June. A link is in the show notes.
Wayfair's Labor Day clearance is back. Now through September 3rd, score up to 70% off everything home. Plus, end summer with can't-miss surprise flash deals. Because at Wayfair, new season means new savings. Like up to 70% off rugs, up to 50% off bedroom furniture, up to 60% off kitchen essentials, and up to 50% off dining furniture. All with fast shipping right to your doorstep. Shop Wayfair's Labor Day clearance now through September 3rd for up to 70% off.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
As a cult survivor himself, Tora Clevier has dedicated years of his life to helping those who have loved ones in cults and those who have exited. Alongside his career as a paramedic, Tora has been a counsellor and educator for over 25 years, specialising in the area of coercive influence and the trauma related to cultic experiences. Before he became president of Cult Information and Family Support, or CIFS, Tora was involved with the volunteer charity organisation since its very formation almost three decades ago in 1996. Regular listeners of this podcast will know that the end of every episode mentions a little Australian organisation called Cult Information and Family Support, or CIFS. We're lucky in Australia to have this incredibly dedicated group of volunteers who support those impacted by cults and offer a variety of assistance to both former members and the loved ones of those affected. But this is a volunteer organisation, and while it's impressive what they achieve already, it would be amazing to see their work bolstered with more financing so that they can have an even greater positive impact. I've wanted to hear more about how CIFS does what it does for some time now, so I'm really pleased to bring you this conversation with CIFS President Tora Clevier today. Tora, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I'm obviously a really big fan of the work that CIFS does in Australia. I've been involved loosely with CIFS since I started the podcast. So first up, I wondered if you could tell me a bit about the history of cult information and family support in Australia, how it formed and what it aimed to achieve.
Yeah, certainly. It's a pleasure to be here. And I'm a great fan of what you do as well, Sarah. It's fantastic to see platforms like yours out there. CIFS started back in 1996, and I've been with CIFS pretty much from its inception. I remember getting together when we were trying to think of a name for it, and we were trying to think of something really, really catchy, and I really didn't agree with CIFS. I thought, it's a bit odd. But anyway, that's what we settled on. So yeah, 1996, it was a group of parents who had children involved in different cults. So it was really started as a meetup in Sydney with half a dozen sets of parents who just got together to support one another. Ros Hodgkins at the time was the current president, and she had successfully helped her daughter to exit a cult with the help of a deprogrammer from America who came out. And it was just a monthly meeting of parents who got together, learned about cults, and I managed to be a part of that. And I think my wife and I and our little family were kind of an example for them to hold up as, people can actually leave. So they gave me a bit of a platform to share our story and stuff like that, which was really helpful.
So from those early days, it sounds like it was really a support group for the parents who had seen their kids get enmeshed in these groups, and it's kind of grown in a few ways from there. How would you say the priorities of CIFS have changed over the years?
Yeah, the underlying priority, of course, has been to create awareness and support for people who have been affected by cults. So in a sense, that hasn't really changed. But the focus has shifted quite a bit. While we still do support people who have a loved one in cults, I suppose the priority has shifted a lot more to people who have left cults now, because we're seeing that, like, since cults really kicked off in the 60s, 70s, we've had a lot of second generation young people coming through. So we've had a lot more cult leavers who are seeking support from us these days as well. So yeah, while we're still approached by parents who need support and a consultation and advice, it really has shifted more to the people who have been directly affected and who have left.
Sure. And you mentioned briefly that your family provided an example of the possibilities to you know, parents who were dealing with this at the time that you were first involved. So what is it that brought you personally to this work?
Being a first-hand witness to the damage that it can cause, and having come out of a cult myself, and just seeing the fallout. When we left the cult we were in, we left from India. I'd been, co-workers asked me if I'd been on the moon for 11 years because I was unaware of how society operated and how, you know, things like banking, things like knowing about sporting heroes, things like music. I was just completely out of touch with all of that stuff. And trying to integrate back into society was huge. In 1986, I left. There was very little known about cults. So seeing that huge vacuum got me started on doing public speaking gigs in schools and things like that, and trying to raise and create awareness around it, because I just saw the potential damage and the fallout from this. And yeah, so that was a huge motivator.
Yeah, I think that's a real personal motivator for me as well, just seeing the amount of damage out there and wanting to figure out ways to, I don't know, stop some of it, or hopefully stop people from getting involved in some way. And so from the perspective of your work with KIFFs and your own personal experiences, what can you tell me about the types of damage that you see in families and individuals who become entangled in cultic groups?
That is a huge question that requires an even huger answer. But the damage is immense, and it's far-reaching. We have the damage caused to the individual who joins and leaves a cult. We have the damage to the families who have a loved one in a cult. We have children who leave cults who have only known a life in the cult and in this coercive environment, who leave and who come with their own story and their own pain. So yeah, families feel like they lose their loved ones. There's a lot of loss and grief and frustration that when a personality change happens with what's usually one of their children that will be recruited into a group, they feel they can't relate to them anymore. So it's been described as the living dead, because their child becomes dead to them. And they can't reach out to them. They can't talk to them. There's been this huge personality transformation, and the parents have just been cut off. So they've got to grieve the loss of this person that they love, but they're still alive. So there's no real closure, and it's hugely difficult for families and very impacting. There's a lot of guilt around it too. You know, what could we have done differently? How could we have stopped this? How could we have prevented this from happening? Yeah, and the harm caused varies hugely, and of course depends on a number of factors, such as things like the amount of time a person spends in a group, how demanding or isolating the group was, because they work on a continuum, on a scale, and what kind of support structures people have when they leave the group. So, yeah, for cult leavers, it's a huge, huge impact in their life, and a huge disruption.
Yeah, and that's, I guess, the main thing that I have spoken to a lot of people about for the podcast, because the main type of interview I do is with someone who has come out of a cult and is talking about their experiences. But that's, yeah, not to understate the trauma felt by those who were the family and loved ones of that person when they went into the cult, and those who are still dealing with that pain if they do still have someone involved. I think that's a really important area that listeners of the podcast might be a bit less aware of, because we don't talk about it quite so much. So I think that's a really important thing to consider as well. And so what types of support are offered by KIFFS to former cult members and also the loved ones of those still involved in high demand groups?
Yeah, we mainly provide education, consultancy, email responses to questions, and we have monthly Zoom support meeting for ex-members mostly. And we have weekend workshops annually for ex-members of cults as well, where they can get together and connect and contribute and really workshop some of the issues that they face. Our consultancy is by appointment and is usually around parents who want to know how to help their loved one or their child get out of the cult. So we often hear, you know, just get them out. How do we get them out? And to explain to people that it's not quite that easy just to get someone out of a cult. And that's a little bit of a helpless position to be in sometimes, to try and get through to parents that it's not just a logical issue and 1, 2, 3, let's just get them out. But it's far more nuanced and complex than that. We also provide counselling referrals. I provide some counselling myself, but I have enough consultancy and other things to do, so I'm referring more and more counselling out to psychologists and counsellors who are aware of this topic, because that's hugely important to cult leavers to have someone who gets it, who understands what it's all about. Yeah, Zoom support groups are... we keep it safe, so people have to have a short interview with myself on the telephone just to ensure that they have actually left a cult and they're not coming to be disruptive in any way. And then, yeah, it's more of a connection rather than a therapy group, where people just get together and connect around a topic or a bit of a discussion. So, yeah.
That's a lot of feedback I've had around the podcast as well, is that actually for people who've left to kind of begin to realise that they're not alone in that experience and that it's a thing that has happened to many other people as well, it can help them to feel a bit less shame or some of those other complicated emotions around it.
Yeah, they come out and feel like they've got two heads, or that they just don't fit into society anymore. And oftentimes they feel like their counsellor or psychologist doesn't understand them either. And they have to field questions similar to a person coming out of a domestic violence situation, like, why didn't you just leave if it was so bad? Why did you stay? And, of course, we now know, because of the similarities between a domestic violence relationship and a cult relationship, are virtually identical. And it's about the undermining of the person's self, sense of self, to the point where they don't feel, well, they feel powerless to leave. They don't feel that they can function without the abuser. And we see, yeah, similar dynamic when people do leave. They will often go back to the cult after a time, or they'll cult hop and go and join some other group. Or more recently, we've found that people have left and gone straight into a domestic violence relationship, because we tend to be attracted to what we know. And yeah, people who have been controlled tend to weirdly feel safe when they're in a controlling relationship. So there's a lot to look at around that whole area.
Like, yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I've seen that happen a number of times with people I've spoken to as well. And I guess it's that feeling of familiarity to the dynamic, that it feels familiar to them. So it makes sense that that would happen. And I also, yeah, I wanted to echo what you were saying about finding appropriate psychological help from someone who understands cult dynamics, because I hear that all the time. You know, someone spent a lot of time trying to explain what's happened to them to a psychologist or a counsellor who doesn't quite get it. So having the appropriate help from someone who really has experience and expertise in that area can make a huge amount of difference to someone who's left. And so this sounds like quite a lot of work to me. And as I understand it, everyone at KIFS is a volunteer. So I was just wondering, how do you cover the costs of doing this work?
Well, step one with budgeting is keep your costs low. So the fact that everyone is a volunteer, it really helps. So we keep our costs right down and no one's paid in this organisation. So, yeah, our funding only comes from memberships and donations, really. We have a membership fee of $45. If anyone out there would like to be a member and help us in that way and get a newsletter occasionally and stay informed and connected, that'd be great. But, yeah, that's about it. We don't, you know, we would love to have people who can write applications for government grants or something like that, but that's a skill in itself and we don't really have the expertise either.
It is really incredible what a, you know, dedicated group of volunteers can achieve. And I know I've spoken to people internationally who wish that they had something similar to KIFS where they are, but I think it's really important to understand this is a volunteer organisation and, you know, there are a lot of issues faced by people coming out of these groups and people who have loved ones enmeshed in them and it really needs a lot more resourcing than really what one volunteer group can provide. But I do think it's amazing what you do. And I think you've already covered this quite a bit in what we've already spoken about. But as someone with both personal experience and involvement in many other people's experiences in this space, what do you see as the major obstacles faced by people who have exited cults?
Yeah, once again, yeah, like I said before, it depends because cults are a continuum and some cults are very, very controlling, physically violent, sexually abusive, while others are more like a controlling organisation. So they're not as impacting. So, yeah, it's hard to nail down the main obstacles, but some people leaving cults, if they don't have family support on the outside, you're looking at things like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which are basic food, clothing, shelter, education. People in many cults will be educated up to year six or something like that, homeschooled, don't have any qualifications. Older people who leave cults, yeah, they won't know how to operate in society. There's a lady in the States who's written a book, and I can't think of the name of the book off the top of my head, but she's written a book for cult leavers so that they can navigate society when they leave. So it's a book of basic helps of how to approach things like Centrelink, how to get basic physical needs met, how to find accommodation, how to write applications for things. And it strikes me as a very helpful book for many people. They often feel very, very isolated. It's a very isolating experience coming out of a cult. And they've been referred to as spiritual refugees as well, because that whole refugee idea of coming into a completely different culture if you've been isolated for a length of time, or similarly for people coming out of prison or, yeah, trying to fit in into society, isn't all that easy. When I came back to Australia after 11 years in the cult, I didn't know how to get money out of the ready teller. That had all changed in the time that I was away. So, yeah, we had no credit rating. We had no rental history. So some of these very basic things we take for granted are really it's a real minefield. It's a real difficult to navigate your way through some of this stuff.
Yeah, I think that all is so true. One of the things I often think about is a young woman I spoke with who came out of a Hare Krishna offshoot cult. And in her childhood, there was, you know, a real rejection of vaccinations or anything like that. So she came out as an adult and had to go back and try and catch up on that vaccination schedule that would have been free for her as a child. But because she was an adult, she had to pay out of pocket for all of those things that, you know, these are the sorts of things that I think people don't realize are faced by those who come out of cults, that, you know, medical costs and things that might have been neglected for years. And as you mentioned, the education side of things can be absolutely huge. So when I first started this podcast, I had no concept of how widespread this problem is. And it's really tricky to do any kind of detailed research and analysis because of the secrecy of so many cultic organizations, as well as the trauma of those impacted, which means many of them just want to try to move on rather than talk about what happened to them. There's also like huge levels of shame and, you know, issues with speaking out in that way. Do you, as KIFS as an organization, have any concept of how big of an issue this is in Australia?
No, I've been asked that question by different reporters. How many cults are there in Australia? And I really don't know. But like on our books for the last, just over the last year, I totaled up 50 different groups. And they're just groups that we've had inquiries about. So I think it's safe to easily double that. But now, even if there were only 50 groups, and we have those 50 groups in every major city in Australia, you've got a significant impact. And also, it depends a little bit about whether you're going to look at the more, well, benign groups. I don't know if any of them are really benign, but some that aren't as controversial as some others, some of the bigger groups or churches that are said to be quite abusive and cultic in their nature as well. And so if we're looking at some of these larger churches that are said to be cults, then it gives us quite a different picture too of the impact and the amount of people involved in damaging or coercive religions. So yeah, difficult question to answer, but I think even on its minor end, even on the lesser end, if we have 50 damaging groups in every major city in Australia, that's pretty significant.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting way to kind of look at that question as well, because I also get asked that question quite a lot, and I find it a very difficult. It's an impossible question to answer. But I do know that I've got a spreadsheet that grows kind of every week with someone sending me an email about a group or another group and asking me if I have any information about them. And people seem surprised that I don't kind of know all of the cults out there, because I've spent 8 years now kind of studying these groups. But there are just untold numbers of them. There's no way you would ever – people think – they ask me when I'm going to run out of cults to cover, and I say I could do this for the rest of my life and I would never run out of cults to cover. And that is not something that I had a concept of when I started the work. So that's what I think about when I'm trying to get my head around the scope of the problem.
Yeah, that is huge, isn't it? And it depends how you define it a little bit. But there's so many small meditation styles, self-development gurus – who operate in the same way as bigger cults. Mm.
And something you just mentioned was about church groups that might be, well, that are quite abusive and could be considered cultic. But I just wanted to, I guess, be really clear that you've got a number of quite religious people who do volunteer at KIFS as well, right? This isn't kind of a religious freedom issue. This is an issue of coercive control and abuse, right?
Absolutely, yes. I have a Christian faith personally. And I see a huge distinction between faith and belief and coercion and control. Yeah, it's quite a different thing. And churches, by and large, don't get this either. They quite often think it's a doctrinal issue or a belief issue. So the Christian churches are quite often in this place where they think if we teach people good Bible teaching, then they won't be susceptible to joining a Bible-based cult, because they'll know that, they'll know a healthy view of Christianity. But that's just completely disregards the coercion and the love bombing and all of the other emotional factors that go into recruiting a person into a cult as well. And another one of those dangers with believing that it's a theological issue is that if you think people are drawn into a cult due to a theological issue, you think that that's a remedy for getting them out as well. And you think if you can just teach them the right things, then they'll leave. But it's much bigger than that.
It's really interesting to hear you speak about it in that way, because I've definitely come across this issue in my work, but I haven't kind of thought about it to the extent that you obviously have, except that, you know, when I'm writing an episode, I'm digging into a cult and I'm trying to understand the belief system. I know that I am not really as interested in the belief system itself as I am in the systems of control and manipulation and the power of those at the top and how they're abusing it, because I think that that's what makes it a cult. And I, you know, certain beliefs can definitely be used to control people, but I don't tend to think that it is an issue of belief or faith. It's much more of an issue of manipulation and coercion that we're looking at when we're talking about this issue, right?
Yes. Yeah, we have cults tend to find a person's need and then exploit that need, just like a good scam artist. And if we're honest, all of us have needs. All of us have psychological needs, emotional needs that are unmet. Needs for acceptance, need for love, need for to be part of a group, need to be something involved in something bigger than ourselves, something to help society. And yeah, these are all healthy, good needs that a cult recruiter can come along and exploit, whatever that is. So for people to say that I could never be recruited into a cult is to kind of say, well, I could never be scammed. And, you know, if we have a financial need, we're much more likely to be scammed by, yeah, some scammer on the internet who offers us an easy way to make money. And that's basically what a cult is. It uses all the techniques and tactics of a good scammer, where they find out what your need is, and then they provide themselves to be the solution for your need. And they personalize it and tweak it to the individual. So, yeah, it's pretty insidious. I think if people saw it more in that light of scamming and being misled, and then they'd probably get their heads around a little bit more how cults do actually pull people in.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think, yeah, we all have different types of groups that appeal to us, and we should be able to join a group and have a community around us in anything that we're interested in, and it'd be a safe thing to do. It's the manipulators at the top of that group that are the issue. So, you know, nobody's going off and joining a cult. They don't see it as a cult. They see it as a wonderful community that they're joining. And I personally was a victim of a massive scam in Australia. It was Melissa Caddick is quite well known in this country for financial scams. So she was the cousin of my partner, and he had known her since he was born. And so he had every reason to trust this woman. You know, we'd been to her house, it had harbour views, like all of these things. And so I know personally what it's like to be a victim of a scam like that from someone who you think that you can trust. And that's exactly how people feel about the leader of the cult and the senior people of the group that they're in. They feel that they should be able to trust these people. These are the people who are often they're looking to as someone who really has aligned to God or something really meaningful. So they have every reason to trust this person, and trusting the wrong person, I don't think it's something that should be blamed on the individual. So yeah, some of those questions that people get asked about, why did you stay? Why didn't you leave? It's kind of placing the emphasis on the wrong part of the problem. And so stepping back, kind of looking at the problem more in a societal sense, I'm wondering what areas of policy and legislation you think might be able to help minimize the harms that you see resulting from these groups and the ways that they operate.
Yeah, another really good and difficult question to answer. I think Nick Xenophon in 2010 was on the right track when he tried to bring in legislation around Scientology in particular, as far as tax reform and things like that, that I think these groups need to be held accountable for the money that they raise, for one thing. I think that would go a long way to curtailing some of the abuses that we see. Just to show that if they're a non-for-profit or under the umbrella of religious freedom or religious tax exemption, that they should have to show that this money is actually being funneled into helping society in some way and not just lining the pockets of leaders. And yes, I think that's one area. And I think also things such as consumer laws. Like, we have fair trading and consumer laws that if you buy a product and it's not as advertised, you can get a refund, or you can sue them, or you can shut them down, or whatever. You have some kind of comeback. cults use coercion to recruit people. And in the cult context, coercion largely means that they have an inside doctrine and an outsider's doctrine. So when you're first joining, you don't really know what they believe, and you don't really know what's going to be expected of you down the track. Sometimes that's because they consciously hide their insider's belief system, and sometimes it's because the cult group changes over time and their beliefs shift and their leader shifts and gets more and more controlling. So, yeah, I think some kind of consumer laws could be really helpful as well.
That's an interesting one I hadn't thought about so much before. The one I think about a lot is around fair work practices, because a lot of people I see coming out of certain cults, they have been in very exploitative working circumstances. They've might have worked really, really long days, long hours, and for no money. Like, all of that has been in service of their cult. And yet, when they go to fair work, apparently they are not considered an employee or a staff member, so there's no recourse for them. So I feel like something around that has to be improved.
Yeah, the slavery laws, and yeah, what is slavery and what is volunteering? Yes, it's a tricky one, but it shouldn't be so tricky really, because surely there are rules around what can be expected of a volunteer. Like, if a volunteer is working 70 hours a week for absolutely no pay, then it's sort of like, yeah, maybe that's a little bit slavery-like.
Yeah, I think there's a bit of work to be done there. And it's just shocking to me that there doesn't seem to be any recourse, unless you take a civil suit, in which case you have to find someone who will represent you. You probably don't have any money because you've come out of a cult, and so you need to find someone who'll do it pro bono, and then you've got to find people to bring a case, and they might all be traumatized. Like, it's just such a huge ask to try and push something forward like that, but it's just a real gap. And I think, as you mentioned, the charity laws are a big one too, because you've kind of got a situation. I believe the way it works in Australia is that you can have a charity if you're a religious organisation, that your public benefit is essentially being a religion and offering religious instruction. So if that religious belief system happens to be coercive, it doesn't stop you from being eligible to be a charity. The public benefit test that exists in other countries is not the same as the one that exists here. You mentioned Senator Nick Xenophon. So for those who aren't aware, he's a former South Australian senator who, as Tora mentioned, made some attempts to introduce legislation in 2010. And I was just wondering if you had any impression of why those didn't really get anywhere.
I don't know a whole lot about governments and government policies and the inner workings of Parliament, but I think they've just got enough on their plate. When we look at all the issues in society and everything that's going on, you know, with housing, recessions looming, wars in various places, you know, homelessness, child trafficking, goodness knows what. Like, there's so many issues. There's so many things in our media about, education, nurses needed in hospitals, we need more doctors, we need this, we need that. Everyone's got their hand out for funding. If you bring laws in, coercion laws and things like that, they require policing. You can bring the laws in, but a law that can't be enforced is not a law at all. So I think even with the domestic violence or coercion laws that were recently passed in New South Wales, I think I'll be interested to see how they can police that, because it's a very rubbery thing to get hold of, you know, what is coercion and what is not, and it's going to require a lot of legal minds and a lot of policing to manage this. And then you expand that over cults and over quite sizable religious groups that are said to be abusive as well. And you open up this huge can of worms that is just going to be unmanageable. So I suspect that governments and policymakers are looking at that and just going, ooh, too hard. And then if you start attacking some of these bigger church groups and lobby groups, you're looking at voters and elections. And, there's a significant amount of people who would object to you based on freedom of religion laws or whatever. So I think too big, too hard. And even though we can see that it needs to happen, people ask me, oh, yeah, how can we get rid of cults? And I say, that's easy. It's easy. There's no cults in communist China, where you have a dictatorship and people are willing to give up all their freedoms to allow the government to police the population. Then we don't have these problems. So, but then in turn we have a political cult then. We have a political regime that controls everybody and everything. So I think with some of this stuff we have to be a little bit careful too, that we're not handing away freedoms under the banner of fighting for safety, if that makes sense. They say that the safest place on the planet is in the prison cell, as long as you stay in your cell. But yeah, so I think it really is tricky, and we're looking at a society now that's trying to police a lot of things, trying to police speech and trying to make laws around hate speech and all of this kind of stuff. And while it all sounds good and it all is good in a utopia, in order to have all this, we're going to have to sell out our freedoms as well. And I think we're entering into a world that is so destabilized that people are becoming more and more willing to sell out their freedoms for security and safety as well. And that scares me a little bit. And it frightens me a little bit that in our pursuit of cults and abuse, that this may be impinging on our religious freedom as well, which I value highly. Hopefully I've ranted long enough on that one.
No, I think that was a very considered and thoughtful response. And I definitely see with the world destabilizing in so many ways. I guess I worry that that's the sort of thing that's also going to drive more people into cultic situations as they kind of seek a feeling of safety and security, and you know, someone tells them that they have all the answers, that's what they might be more susceptible to that message. But no, I think that that's all true. And I think we do need to be really careful about not impinging on religious freedom. Religious freedom is incredibly important. But I think that there's ways of kind of untangling those two issues and making sure that you're kind of separating out the cultic groups from the religious groups, who should really be on side with wanting their organizations not to be coercive and controlling and abusive. But as we know, sometimes they're not so on board with that. So it's a really important and difficult conversation to have. But I hope for a future where everyone can be a bit more on the same page about that stuff and wanting to do what it takes to root out abuses and coercion and all of these things from those organizations. And so you've mentioned already KIFS runs on kind of membership and donations. Is that the best thing that listeners can do if they'd like to support the work of KIFS in Australia?
As far as direct assistance, yes. We can use help managing our website and databases and things like that. But obviously, we would have to vet whoever were to offer to help us with that. We need the right person. But if there is anyone else out there who's a web designer or something who'd like to volunteer a little bit of their time to post different things and manage our website, that would be really helpful. If you're a person with influence, if you work in a university, if you're a lecturer, if you work in a secondary school or in mental health, or if you're a counsellor or a psychologist, we all need to raise awareness. So if we can get awareness into our schools and universities around this topic, it would be fantastic. If you don't know how to do that, please contact us. We have a lot of information. We have prepared overhead talks and things like that that you can present, or that you can invite us or someone from our organization to come and present. And students are especially vulnerable. So if there's any way that we can get this kind of information into school or uni curriculums or any platforms where young people will hear this and therefore be more prepared and not as targeted, it's very, very needed, because we teach people how to add up and read, but we don't necessarily teach them a lot of these life skills that they need in order to survive when they do hit the big world. And young people are especially vulnerable because they are in a process of individuating from their parents and learning to make their own decisions as well. So their parents are often the last people that they will listen to while they're in their teenage years because they want to make their own decisions. And cults will play on that as well and say things like, you're an adult, you don't need other people to tell you what to do, you can make your own decisions, can't you? And all of these things are very appealing to young people. And if they don't know what's happening and if they don't know how manipulation and coercion works, then they're going to be very, very susceptible. And we have cults that are particularly targeting universities at this time in Australia. And at KIFS, we have sent out letters of awareness to different universities as well. Some unis are really getting on board with this, and they're creating their own awareness, putting out leaflets, flyers for their students. And this is really needed. We need more of this, for sure. So yeah, if there's anyone who wants to know how or wants information or anything like that, please get in touch. We need awareness out there.
Oh, I hadn't even thought of half of those things. That's so fantastic. I think that that's absolutely right. If we can get these messages in schools, and particularly, as you mentioned, because universities are really such ripe recruiting grounds for many of these cults, and intentionally so. I speak to a lot of people who joined when they were around university age or came across a recruiter at a university. And it's, that point in life where people are kind of trying to figure out who they are and they want to dedicate themselves to something. They're looking at what their life is going to be and their identity. So it's just a prime time that you can come across the wrong group at the wrong time and invest your wonderful idealism and energy into something that perhaps is not so wonderful and ideal. Before we finish up, is there anything else you'd like to mention, Tora?
I suppose I'd just like to emphasize that it's not an easy process to get someone out of a cult. And I often have people saying, how can I get my child out? And there's more to it than that. It's more like understanding that your loved one has either like a drugless addiction or a relationship with this group that is very hard to shake. So you can't logically talk someone out of an emotional connection, an emotional need, and emotional relationship.
Just quickly, I suppose, because I totally agree with you, and I have people ask me that question all the time, and it's such a heartbreaking response to have to give to someone that actually there's not an awful lot you can do to get someone out. But do you have advice to what parents and families can do if they have someone involved in one of these groups?
Yes. Step one is cults tend to warn people on day one almost that they will be persecuted by their families and that their families will disagree with them and that their families and loved ones will try and talk them out of their situation. So by attacking your child or your loved one who's in the group and just telling them off or telling them, just wake up to yourself, you're falling right into this and actually it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, really. And so it proves the cult right. They told me this would happen. Now my parents are attacking me. So, I'll have to cut them off because the cult has the truth. So from that, we can see that relationship and maintaining relationship is step one. Or reforming relationship with your loved one. If you have gone and just said, look, you've got rocks in your head, you've joined this wacky group and we don't agree with that, then it may be a matter of restoring relationship and saying, look, we understand that you're becoming an adult and we respect your right to make decisions and we just want to stay close to you. And that's step one. And after you have restored relationship or reformed relationship as much as you can, then possibly they'll be in a position to listen to what you have to say down the track.
I think that's excellent advice. And I think also even if you can't reach that point of being able to talk to them about what your real opinion is of the group, the fact that they know that they have support and unconditional love outside of the group, if they ever do down the line start to have those questions and start to question what they're involved with, then they know there's somewhere to turn, and that can be incredibly important to someone's path out.
Yes. Recently we've done interviews with people who have left a Korean cult, and there's a lot of ex-members who have gone through this group, and they've been part of our support group discussions, and we're hearing over and over again from them that the best thing that their parents did was maintain a loving relationship with them, and that had their parents argued with them or fought with them or tried to talk them out of it, that they probably wouldn't have left. So we're getting a lot of just reinforcing discussion around that idea from people who are leaving and leaving these groups recently, that love is the answer, love is the key.
Yeah, and I guess don't give up. It can be a really difficult thing because sometimes this process takes many, many years, which is so difficult for those who have a loved one that they're worried about in a cultic group. It's been so fantastic to speak with you, Tora. Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and your experience with me for the podcast. And where can people find out more about KIFS and where to support you?
Yeah, if they go to our website on www.cifs.org.au or info@kifs.org.au, they can email us. It's better to email us first and make an appointment if you think you want to talk. We can't man the phone 24 hours a day, but yeah, we're happy to have a chat with you by appointment. So yeah, looking forward to hearing from any of your listeners, Sarah.
Fantastic. And those links will be in the show notes, so you can click right through if you want to find out more. And thank you so much, Tora.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Thanks so much for joining me again for this episode of Let's Talk About Sects. And a big thanks to Tora Clevier for his time and to KIFS for all the work they do in this space. I recommend you head to their website to find out more about what they do and support their endeavours if you're able to. As always, you can access ad-free episodes and support the production of this independent podcast via Patreon or Acast Plus, or with a one-off donation or merch purchase. You can also listen to my audiobook, Do As I Say, which is linked in the show notes, and grab yourself a copy of Joe Gould's soundtrack album, Nobody Joins a Cult, which you can also stream on Spotify. This episode of Let's Talk About Sects was produced by me, Sarah Steele. Original music composed by Joe Gould.